From the UFO Festival in Roswell, New Mexico, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. What an incredible moment out here. You know, this is the first time I've been in Roswell, New Mexico, and of course, this being the 60th anniversary of this incredible crash, we're going to be talking with a number of guests here tonight. Let me set the stage for you just for a moment. First of all, there are thousands of people who have come down to Roswell, New Mexico from all over the place. I've met people from Louisiana, Alabama, Roswell, New Mexico. They're all over the place, and they're having a great time. They're watching concerts and everything else. But more importantly, they are diehard listeners of Coast to Coast AM, and they want to find out the truth, as so many of us always do. And I want to thank, first of all, the so many people here in Roswell who have been very gracious to producer Tom and myself, who have just opened up their doors. Well, sort of. They didn't let us in their house. We wanted to, but they didn't do that. And they've been just delightful here, and it's a great part of the country. And the Roswell Police Department has been absolutely superb. Producer Tom only had two speeding tickets in Roswell today, which normally he gets six or seven. So that is doing well, and one of them we're trying to get fixed. I don't know if we're going to be able to pull that off. But they have been just incredible, watching us, following us. Actually, they could be the men in black. I'm not sure. But they're here. Anyways, let me tell you some of the news of the day, and then we are going to get right into our first guest. We're going to have a series of guests coming in all night long. Okay, welcome back to the UFO Festival in Roswell, New Mexico. I'm George Norrie, live here with a number of guests. 60th anniversary here. You know these two. Of course, they were on the program several weeks ago, but we get to see them in the flesh. Stanton Friedman received his B.S. and M.S. degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 1956, where Carl Sagan was once a classmate. Stanton, I refer to him, too, as the father of modern-day ufology, an expert in Roswell. And, Stan, I've got to tell you, when I first met you in 1971, you actually look younger now than you did 36 years ago, for crying out
loud. I'll pay you later, George.
You really do. Are you sure you're from this world?
No, I live in Canada.
And, of course, this man's name has been going all around the country lately. He's the author of the book, The Roswell Legacy, and he's the son of the late Colonel Jesse Marcel. Jesse Marcel, Jr. joined the U.S. Navy in 1962 and was assigned to the USS Renville and shortly thereafter participated in the Cuban Missile Crisis, attached to combat units as a member of the ship's company. Now, he's a medical doctor, 68 years old, Jesse, if I remember, right around there.
71.
71, okay. Back from Iraq, where you just served some duty.
13 months worth.
Absolutely incredible. Thank you for serving us, by the way. And Jesse's father was part of the group that picked up the crash debris at Roswell. Stanton, Jesse, they're here with us as we talk about what's going on with this festival. It seems lately, Stan, that the Roswell case is getting a lot of publicity now. A lot of things from you, Jesse, Tom Carey, Don Schmidt, the affidavit of Lieutenant Walter Hout that has now come out.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're getting close to finding out what happened.
We certainly seem to be getting closer, and there's been a more open attitude by the media. I've had loads of questions about Tom and Don's book, for example. And I was the one who found Walter Hout lo these many years, late 70s. And obviously people are paying attention to what's going on, and I guess their book is selling like hotcakes. So is Jesse's new book, The Roswell Legacy, and my new book, Captured. I mean, there seems to be a breakthrough somehow, and the media has gotten off the anti-UFO kick, and they've recognized, I suppose because of that Chicago Tribune story on January 1st, mm-hmm. that the public is really interested in this subject. Now, you can go outside during the day here and see how many people are here who drove 200 miles to get here or 2,000 miles. But, Roswell has come back into prominence, and I don't know, I mean, two new books in a few-week period, Don and Tom's and Jesse's, and people at the museum, where I've been all day, are constantly asking questions. I spoke to, they need a bigger museum because the room I was scheduled in was packed with people. It was too darn warm.
Well, you do.
People are interested. So I've been very, I was here for the 50th anniversary, of course. Mm-hmm. And it's good to see that people are coming back here. I had somebody tell me just a few days ago, oh, Roswell's passe, nobody cares about that. Well, you can tell from being here that they do care.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, we're not on the way to anywhere. If they're here, they want to be here. They're enjoying themselves.
You know, Jesse, yesterday on Coast to Coast, I read the Walter Hauss affidavit.
Right.
And in it, he mentioned your father. And he mentioned how your father talked about the crash debris.
Right.
But what I found very, very fascinating was he mentioned that after your father left the room where the debris was, some of the debris was brought in, he came back and said that General Ramey had exchanged it for some balloon material, and that your dad was very, very upset about it.
Well, he was. You know, that photograph of him in General Ramey's office holding up a very obvious radar target, and look on his face, and you're like, you got to be kidding me. You know, he was totally flabbergasted by that, but he was told that this is where the cover-up was going to begin, and it stayed that way, and he became part of the cover-up by following orders. He was a good soldier.
I saw you on Fox News just recently, and you did a great job. I'm not sure they took you seriously. Did you get that feeling?
There's a little bit of feeling like that, yes.
It is so important, Stanton Friedman, that the mainstream media begin to look at this subject as they do just about everything else they try to unravel on this planet.
Yeah, it's time for the investigative journalists to do their job. They've been missing from the scene for most of the last 60 years. And now, you know, we're losing witnesses. After all, it's been 60 years. And I'm hoping that the response to this festival will move us in that direction, that it'll be taken more seriously. There's a lot of media people here. I don't know if there's as many as there were 10 years ago, but there are over 300 journalists here. And I was doing interviews all the time.
Is that more than you've seen in past situations here?
Here so far, I can't say it's more. No, not yet. But I haven't been. Remember, I've been sort of down at the museum.
Yeah, that's
true.
They're
two separate. That's one of the big differences this time. Then it was all one coordinated program.
Yeah,
so people sort of flowed back and forth. Now there are two. And so I did things then at both places. And this year it's only at the museum. So I'm not in a good position to judge what else is going on because I'm not psychic. I'm a dumb old physicist, not a bright psychic. You know?
You've been kicking around in the field of ufology for how long?
I've read the first book in 49 years. I've been lecturing for 40 years.
What is it that got you interested in it? What happened?
I read a book. What else? I was a young nuclear physicist. I'm working for General Electric on nuclear airplanes. Everybody does that. This is 1958. And I was ordering books. I needed one more book from a discount place. There was one, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Captain Edward Ruppelt, Project Blue Book head in the early 50s. And I found out tonight, incidentally, we had a little gathering of a new group of seven researchers, and three of us got started by reading Ruppelt's book. It was a kind of important book. Anyway, it didn't convince me, but it intrigued me. And I moved to California, read 15 more books, some of which were utter junk. And if I'd read one of them first, I'd have never read another book.
Yeah.
See, I respected the Air Force because they were a co-sponsor on the nuclear airplane program. Some of my attitudes about the Air Force have changed a bit the last few years as they do all their debunking. But what really turned me on was finding Project Blue Book Special Report 14 at the University of California, Berkeley Library. A study of 3,201 cases, and it hadn't been mentioned in any of the 15 books that I had read. And I discovered, I'm a data hound, and there were 240 charts, tables, graphs, maps, data heaven. And then there was a statement from the Secretary of the Air Force lying through his teeth. And that, look, I had a security clearance. I was accustomed to you be a little careful what you say. Maybe sure. You don't reveal everything. But when you flat out lie, he said the on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those popularly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Similar statements have been repeated many times. The only problem with that statement is it's totally false. The unknowns were 21.5%, not 3%. They were completely separate from the 9.5% that had insufficient data. They did a quality evaluation. The better the quality, the more likely to be unknown. Exactly what you'd expect if they were really different. But they went a step farther. They did a cross comparison, apparent size, color, shape, speed, six different characteristics, unknowns versus knowns. They found the probability the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%. So that really shook me up, and it got me rolling. Read a lot more books, got started on a radio program, George, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I had called the program. They weren't interested in having me on. Then I get a call one night, 6:30 for a 7 o'clock talk show on KDKA, big station.
Yeah.
Could I please go on? Somebody had canceled, and they must have called six other
they
people.
They were desperate. They needed you.
You're right. And I didn't know how to handle a host who didn't know what he was talking about. I've learned since. But that led to my first lecture in somebody's living room. Then I did the chicken and peas circuit. What the real breakthrough for me was speaking to professional groups, engineering societies all over the place.
Yes.
And it was their enthusiastic response that when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space systems business, as it did in 1970, that led me to go full-time on UFOs.
I believe that's where I met you in Detroit, because I think you were speaking to the Detroit Engineers Group back in 1971.
Well, I'm pretty sure I spoke to a whole bunch of groups in Detroit.
Pretty sure.
But, I stress that because some people think it's only the kooks and weirdos and wackos who are interested in UFOs. Nothing could be further from the truth.
You were one of those who basically found, years later, 1978-ish, Jesse Marcel's father.
Well, I was the one. I was referred to him by a television station manager who was embarrassed because his reporter who was supposed to interview me wasn't there on time, and he knew I had other things to do.
Uh-huh.
I was speaking at LSU. And he's looking at his watch, he's giving me coffee, and out of the blue he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And brilliant investigator that I am, I said, who's he? Oh, well, he handled wreckage of one of these saucers you were interested in when he was in the military. Well, I picked my teeth up off the floor. What do you know about him? Lives over in Houma. I didn't know where Houma was.
And how old was Junior at the time?
In 78?
Yeah.
Oh, I was about 32 years old.
Okay, so you were up there in age.
Yeah.
But when you were a little boy, Jesse, your father brought home some debris, and you saw something with some inscriptions on it.
Well, yes, he brought some debris in from the field. It was so unusual, he wanted my mother and myself to examine it because he realized that this was extraordinary, very unique material. And so he brought it into the house so we could examine it. And I said, first of all, look for any electronic components in this floor full of material that you spread out there, and none like that. But then there was some unusual debris, like the I-beams, or what I call I-beams.
Right.
Metal beams with writing or symbols written along the inner surface of it.
They look Egyptian?
Well, I thought at first it was Egyptian hieroglyphics, but no, there was no animals or birds or snakes or whatever. But they're more like geometric symbols of various configurations, all imprinted along the inside surface of this I-beam.
Are you convinced now, Jesse, that with the material your father saw, with the things that you now know Walter Haut has basically said in his affidavit, that what happened in 1947 was out of this earth?
Yeah. I've known that for many, many years.
Yeah.
You know,
it was always there.
From day one, from the get-go, I realized that there was something extraordinary about this, that this was not one of our creation.
How do you feel knowing that we were visited by beings from another planet?
Well, it certainly may be interesting in astronomy and cosmology, because I realize we're not the only ones here, that there's enormous possibilities of life elsewhere, as you know. You know, in our galaxy, there's 400 billion stars, and they never had found stars or planetary systems around other stars, but the Hubble telescope started picking planetary systems up. So about half the stars have planetary systems, so there's a lot of blue Earth-like planets out there.
Roswell Legacy, it's a great read. And Stanton, a couple minutes to go, but I do want to ask you about this. Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience, I think one of the best documented abduction cases I've ever seen.
Oh, no question. And the important thing about the book is that the co-author, who honestly did most of the work, was Kathleen Martin, who's Betty's niece.
Ah.
And she's got all her files, all those tapes. She's transcribed things. She was the executrix of Betty's estate. She heard about the sighting the day after it happened because her mother was Betty's younger sister, who got called by Betty the next day. So she's been close to this right from the start. And we got a lot of stuff in there that's never been published before. We also have the star map work that tells us where those beings came from. And I take on the nasty, noisy negativist, as is my wont, as you know. And so
it's your role.
That's my role.
As the senior member.
I'm going to be a great grandfather soon. You don't need to rub it in, George.
But you do. You do a great job, and this is a great case. And I want to have you back on Coast to Coast at a later time to give you the justice with this story.
Thank you. It's an exciting story.
Jesse, as you've been walking around Roswell, where you were here many years ago, what's it like for you? Has it changed much?
Well, I would not recognize Roswell compared to what it was 60 years ago. Yeah, when I was here 60 years ago, the New Mexico Military Institute was outside of town. Now, most of the town is on the side of
They've got a Home Depot here now.
I know. Roswell is growing up.
Sam's.
It's on the map now.
Gas stations. And I think fast food places.
Yeah, I think the Roswell event put Roswell on the map.
Tom and I flew into Albuquerque, and then they had a driver pick us up there because we didn't want to fly in a little tiny Cessna. We didn't want to crash coming to a crash conference. And so we rode in and saw this incredible storm coming through. But the one thing I noticed was the vast lands out here. And we're trying to picture a crashed saucer. And there were two of them, of course, one in Roswell, one near Corona, as you stated many, many times, Stan. But just it was so void out there. And I was trying to picture a saucer down out there. Yeah. Man, it's way out.
Well, there's a lot of open spaces, like Big Sky Country, like Montana. Montana has the name of Big Sky Country, but I think New Mexico should be in there also.
Yeah, it's a wonderful state, too. Yeah. Both of you, thank you for coming by, and enjoy the rest of the conference. I know a lot of people came here to see you, too, and you do what you do, and you do it very well. Thanks, George,
very much.
Is my website on, and our website's on your...
I'm sure it is, and if it's not, it will be.
Okay. www.stantonfriedman.com, and Marcel
is...
JR.com.
You got it. Very good. Yeah. I'm George Norrie. We're live at the 60th anniversary of the Roswell crash. It's their UFO festival, and I shall be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Yep, and we are live at the Roswell UFO Festival in Roswell, New Mexico. And having a great time. Thousands of people out here coming and going. Just an absolute delight. And with us now, co-hosting the rest of the program, Richard C. Hoagland, in from Albuquerque. Hey, Richard, how are you?
In person, with Robin over there.
And are you wearing a bola?
Yes, of course I'm
you
wearing a bola.
Are. Traditional.
It's to Mexico. Come on, where's your bola, George?
I am not going to wear a bola. Good to have you.
Do you know it's
us.
Been declared by Richardson the official tie of the state?
I didn't know that.
You are illegal because you're not wearing a bola tonight?
Okay, well, we'll get one of the fine Roswell officers to rush out and break into a store and get me one of these things. But Richard will be with us throughout the entire night. We've got a number of guests coming in. Some of them I think you'll find as an absolute surprise. But right now we're also doing some behind the secret doors. And popping in right now is a fellow I have met at several conferences and has been a regular contributor here at Coast to Coast. His name is Richard C. Hoagland.
It is Dr. Louis Torrey.
Absolutely. Hi, hey, Louis, how are you?
Doing good. Thank you very much.
I went to a restaurant tonight with Tommy, and all of a sudden I look in the corner, and there's this guy sitting there munching down on health food, and it's Dr. Torrey.
Well, doesn't he look healthy?
He comes up to our driver and immediately begins to tell him his entire life in like 3 minutes. Ah. Absolutely amazing. How do you do that, Liz?
Well, it's a gift, you know, since my UFO contacts. To me, there is no guessing. There is no magic. It's real. Dealing with UFOs since I'm 6 years old and being downloaded the universal codes in my trips inside the flying saucers allows me to do that.
You and Tom must have the same tailor.
Now that's true.
What did you say that for?
No, I think Lewis's tailor's a little more upscale than Tom's. This is what we go through when we do live remotes all the time in Richard C. Hoagland's neck of the woods. What'd you think, by the way, of that $19 million toilet?
Well, it should have been 19.5.
Can you believe that?
Well, you know, George, there is an old expression. When you gotta go, you got to go.
Yeah. I love it.
Man, when you got to pay, you got to pay.
Is this tax dollars? American tax dollars?
Sure.
Oh, my gosh. I would do a better.
Well, this is the crowd that brought you the $600 hammers. Remember those?
Uh-huh.
No, well, I mean.
It happens. I bet it happens in your old neck of the woods, France.
Yeah, well, indeed.
Actually, not to put, you know, too light of this, doing something like that, which is so necessary in zero gravity, is not trivial. I mean, they have spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars on zero gravity personal hygiene.
Right.
And I used to know Bonnie Dunbar was an astronaut back when I was with CNN.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked with her and Kevin Sanders about the problems of doing what we all have to do in zero gravity. It's a huge problem. And the fact that the Russians have cracked it for 19 million tells you something about their practical approach to space technology versus our approach.
I don't know. Maybe I'm cheap, Richard, but it sounds like a lot of money. Anyways, a couple more minutes to go here with you.
Not if you were up there and you were...
Well, that's true, too. Lewis' notoriety, because he makes incredible predictions, 9/11, the tsunami, the Iraq War, and you come on the program, and a lot of the things you've talked about the weather lately have come true as well.
Indeed. And I'd like to give another date, if I may.
Yes, you may.
July the 30th. I want you to make a little note for some serious surprise, and that could be anything from explosion to about earthquake. I ain't going to say anything else. I'm just giving one date, July the 30th.
All right, Lewis, my friend.
Check it out when time comes.
What's your website?
DrTuri.com.
Doctor with a D-R. Right?
Yeah, DrTuri.com. And I give my book for free, as always, and my newsletter is available for people who wants to learn. Gather cosmic consciousness, read my prediction. It's all on the website.
All right. Go ahead, Richard.
By the way, you know, Dr. Turi was 100% right about the last shuttle station mission.
Yes, he was.
Remember, he said there was a major set of problems.
And there was.
And all six computers crashed in the Russian section.
Yeah.
And it looked like it might have, you know, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Could have been a disaster. Thanks, Lewis.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of the festival. Richard C. Hoagland and I will be right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, live at Roswell, New Mexico, with our sidekick, color commentator, Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com.
You know, I haven't done this in a while.
It has been a long time.
This is kind of cool.
Want me to do my Cronkite impression?
Absolutely.
Hello, Richard. Good evening. This is Walter Cronkite.
Hi.
Go get me a cup of coffee.
He didn't ask that.
No, he didn't.
He asked me to actually calculate.
But you were young then.
He asked me where to place his boat during a total solar eclipse.
All right. Well, that's a wise question.
And he made it.
All right. Introduce our next guest, Richard.
On my left, for everyone in the radio audience, Brian Temmer is the founder and president of Alien Apex Resort. In 2005, as a longtime roller coaster enthusiast and science fiction buff, Brian combined the information he obtained from his research, his unique and creative ideas, his interest in alien phenomena, and his desire to entertain and provide happiness to others into a vision of the opening of the Alien Apex Resort theme park right here in Roswell, New Mexico. Brian apparently has received some extremely positive feedback, which I'm sure he's going to tell us about, from industry experts, as well as a strong commitment from the city of Roswell itself. Brian, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The Alien Apex Resort theme park? What the heck is that?
Well, as everyone knows, Roswell is the apex of everything alien and UFO, so that's really how that idea of that name came to me one evening.
What's going to be there? I mean, you're going to have crashed saucers there? Aliens? What?
Well, the featured attraction is going to be an alien abduction roller coaster. You will sit down.
You're serious.
I am serious. You're going to be strapped in, and you're going to be on the most sophisticated steel roller coaster in existence. And you are going to be moving through a probably Midwestern town, moving into a house, and all of a sudden you're going to see lights coming through a window, and your roller coaster is going to accelerate to a vast speed, and you're going to find yourself moments later on board a ship, an alien craft, and you're going to have probes and other interesting objects coming at you. You will be then moving into a room where you will see the Earth hurling away from you as you move into deep space, wondering if you'll ever get back, which, of course,
this is exciting.
You do.
This sounds like Universal theme park.
It'll be better, much better.
But with that UFO flavor, I mean, this is something.
Have you been to the Star Trek Experience in Las Vegas?
I have.
Have you?
No, I have not.
It sounds like this will do that one better. Robin and I went a couple, 3 years ago, and it was cutting edge, state of the art then.
Is this virtual animation?
This is actually you're in a physical, hydraulically moved gadget, like a roller coaster, except you move, you sway, you have screen stuff coming past you. I mean, it sounds to me like that's what you have in mind.
Yeah, much more exciting, though, because it actually is an interactive experience. Not only are you being abducted, but the aliens will be trying to communicate with you, and based on your response, the animatronics will react differently. That's, of course, just one very exciting part of the theme park. And this is a way to celebrate, of course.
There aren't any anal probes in this.
No,
right?
Okay, no. Okay. You know, and it's funny because everybody seems to ask me that question. but no, not yet, and I don't think ever. But one of the exciting things is when I talk to theme park industry experts about this idea is the first thing they say is, I can't believe that Roswell does not have an alien theme park already.
How big is this going to be, Brian?
Well, I'd like it to be at least 150 acres as far as size. Yeah.
Absolutely huge.
It is.
You know, many years ago when I was starting my Sedonia quest, I talked with one of the major industry people south of San Francisco, whose names remain nameless, and he asked me what I would think of a Sedonia theme park. I mean, it sounds to me like, Brian, you ought to have at least a Sedonia wing on this thing.
Well, there's a possibility. One of the things I'd like to do with the park is, of course, have the celebration of the Roswell incident, but also the exploration of life outside of the Earth.
How would you depict that, Brian?
Well, that I think a lot about SETI, and I know that there's a lot of debate about what SETI is doing and their own beliefs about UFOs, but I certainly think that there are going to be people visiting this park that are going to be skeptics, there are going to be believers, and there's going to be people in between and just people that want to have a good time. And I think it's very important to celebrate all of those aspects of it and let people have an opportunity to explore and understand that there is definitely life outside of the Earth. The possibility that there isn't, I think, is minuscule. So I want to say for people that may not fully accept the Roswell incident that there is an opportunity to explore from a scientific aspect those types of issues as well.
Do you live out here?
No, I don't. I actually live in Florida.
Oh, well, you can.
Which is home to many theme parks.
There.
Do you? I mean, this is an extraordinarily interesting vision because it sounds to me like you're holistic in that you go from the hard sciences
right
through where we are now, which is we've got 206 planets we've discovered. You know, we're talking about, you know, radio signals, things like that. And then you move into the history that this town epitomizes, which is that they're here, and you're planning an integrated experience.
Absolutely. And I also foresee one day when contact will be made, and I strongly believe that it will be at this park, because what better place for an alien to finally come and say hello to everybody than at a theme park? And the first thing they probably want to do is ride that roller coaster.
What do you think happened back here in 1947, Brian?
Oh, I'm certain that something very specific happened. In fact, I had taken a ride just today out to Hangar 84, just walking around, taking a couple of
Isn't
pictures.
Isn't that interesting?
And the feeling that I got was overwhelming. And, of course, I knew what it was, but there's something mystical about that building, and it's the kind of thing when you, like, feel something and you just are completely inspired and overwhelmed, and that was the feeling that I had. And I'm certain that something did take place, but I'm also an understanding person about the time, and I realized that if any of us were in that situation, we would want to protect our beings, our state of life, the government, and things like that. And we would be concerned. A couple of years after World War II ended, it's probably not the most appropriate time to let the world know that we're being visited by beings that we don't fully understand. They have technology that we don't understand, and they may be a threat that we can't stop.
You know what's amazing, Richard and Brian? Well, this is my first trip to Roswell. And, you know, I've been a news person all my life, first and foremost. Paranormal investigator, researcher, leader.
Couple Emmys.
You know, three. But I came here as a news person, not the host of Coast to Coast Today, because I wanted to watch the faces of people in Roswell to see if this was a put-on or not. I believe Stanton Friedman. I believe Jesse Marcel Jr. I believe that affidavit that Walter Hout had signed. But I wanted to see the people of Roswell. I wanted to see if they were just doing this to keep this city's tourism hot. And I got to tell you, these people here
believe what happened out there. And they talk about it. And yes, this is a major event every year, and it's a tourist attraction every year. But I'm going away from this. When I go back to Los Angeles tomorrow, I am going away from this event believing now in my heart that the people who live in Roswell, New Mexico, truly believe that something crashed here out of this world in 1947.
The thing that's interesting to me, I mean, this is the second time I've been here. Robin and I came down a couple, 3 years ago. A lot of the people, a lot of the thousands of people, thousands and thousands, are not from Roswell.
No.
They
no.
have come here from literally
all over the place.
All over the world.
All over the place. I've had people from Denver, as I was saying, Louisiana, Alabama, Florida. They're just showing up all over the place.
So if, Brian, your vision came true, and I want to get to an important point on that in a second, an awful lot of people would make the pilgrimage, and I use that term very specifically, because for them, it's a time whose time has come. I mean, this Haupt memo, to me, is a really defining moment, because finally we have the senior authority figure, the public information officer for the Air Force, saying in this extraordinary affidavit, this really did happen. This is an historic place. And I think a theme park, given that your broad vision is from science to the most speculative, where what does it mean? So my question is, how close are you to actually pulling this off?
I believe I'm very close. Recently, the state of New Mexico approved a legislative appropriation of $245,000 for the initial business planning and
Fantastic.
Basic layout of the park. And we've been working for the past 2 years. I've been working directly with Zach Montgomery, the city planner. And without his help, none of this would have happened. And we're very close to bringing this to reality.
Well, you know, some of the big boys, Anheuser-Busch with their theme parks now, and, you know, they have Busch's Gardens.
Well, the polls that you read at the top of the show indicate there's a huge customer base of people that want to know more. And I can envision, given the fact that I envision some things from time to time, that this could become a mecca where people that wanted to know, that are not getting it through the regular media, could come and educate themselves, meet other like-minded people. I remember back when Gene was trying to get Star Trek into the franchise business and into the films, the convention started. And a lot of Star Trek people who didn't realize there were other crazies out there finally personally got in touch with each other and realized, oh, hey, I'm not the only strange person that believes in this stuff. So this park is definitely an interesting concept. Again, how close are you to actually making it happen?
I mean, how many years away do you think, realistically?
Well, I'm
not
going to
make us wait 60 years like we're doing on this anniversary.
Well, once we've got an RFP going on right now because we've got the funds, and we're in the process of selecting a final company that's going to do the full-scale design. It's going to be one of the top-notch companies in the world, ones that have worked with large companies like Universal, Disney, things like that. So we're very close to selecting that. It's going to be the end of this month. Once we have that, it'll probably take them a couple of months to put that plan together and make a formal presentation to the theme park industry. And I strongly believe, as I always have, even 2 years ago, that this was going to happen.
Is Richardson involved in this?
Yeah.
Because he was heavily involved in the spaceport, which is just over the hill.
Right. A presentation was made to
his team. That's a heavy hitter.
And,
but you do know, though, Brian, that you are going to have to put a 60-foot statue at the entrance of Richard C. Hogan. That's why he wants to know how soon it's going to die.
Well, what I'd like to
with
do...
With Ebola.
Yeah,
course.
Right. Oh, of course.
Official tie of the state.
Five years is what I would expect before you can walk through the gates. And the reason I choose 5 years is...
2012?
Exactly, is 2012.
Oh, come on.
No, that's exactly why, because that is...
There are no coincidences.
That is the year that the end of the world is predicted on the Mayan calendar, but I believe what it is a beginning of a new age of discovery and entertainment. And I really believe this theme park, besides being a place to have a great time, it's going to be a place to prepare everyone, because one day it's going to happen where everyone simultaneously is going to meet up with beings that are not part of this earth. It's one of those things that's written already.
Why don't you build a landing pod spot? You know, like they did in Close Encounters of the Third.
Was it Kentucky? There was a city council that actually
appropriated I don't know where it was. They were going to build a landing pad for a UFO.
And wouldn't it be ironic that a theme park that opens up 65 years after the Roswell incident is the place that eventually first contact is made?
You're really planning on 2012?
I am.
That is kind of
cool. But you know what? They may come back and say, where are our three inhabitants from 1947?
Yes. No, I think what's going to happen is they're going to arrive and they're going to say, I can't believe you're charging me for parking.
Or they'll or they'll say, take us to your leader and see the 60-foot statue of Richard C. Hoagland.
Yes, that can happen.
You know, George, as you know, I have a political bent on these things. In fact, that's one of the reasons I wanted to come this year, because it's the 60th tetrahedral anniversary. And those numbers are important in terms of government operations, and we spent a lot of airtime on Coast talking about that. I have another interesting question.
And we've got 35 seconds to get it in.
Okay. And if I could remember it, I would...
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Hey, Brian Temper, good luck in this project.
Yes, and, Brian.
Thanks for the hospitality here in Roswell.
Oh, no, thanks, George. I appreciate it.
Now, we've got a little surprise for you coming up, which I'll tell you about right now in just a moment. Chase Masterson. Yep, she was with Star Trek. You mentioned Star Trek. Deep Space Nine and Dean Haglund from X-Files. They're joining us.
I was hoping you'd let me sit in on this one.
Of course, and I'll tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to open up the phone lines because I want to get you involved. We'll open up the phone lines for the next half hour right here, and you can talk with Chase Masterson and Dean Haglund yourself right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie along with Richard C. Hoagland, wearing bola and all, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. We're live at the UFO Festival in Roswell, New Mexico. Yes, you can tell we are live. That is not canned claps. Those are real people. Richard C. Hoagland, you're introducing our next guest.
Rotating people. Okay, Chase Chase Masterson first became known for her. Now, don't do that. Come on. This is supposed to be a serious idea.
Oh, yeah, okay, serious.
Please.
Chase first became known for her breakout role in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Chase was voted the number one favorite science fiction actress on television by the TV Guide Online Readers Poll. As well as honored as one of the top 20 people to watch in Hollywood. And sitting here, I can tell you why. That was by Sci-Fi Universe magazine. Anyway,
I voted.
Chase is often recognized, although I didn't recognize her because she changed her hair color, from her role as the featured guest star in the Emmy Award-winning episode of ER. You might recognize her from her role as Commanding Officer Callie O'Grady in Stephen King's Frozen.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, Chase.
Wow, that was a doozy there. Welcome. Thank you so much, Richard. Nice to be here.
And the other guy making all that noise over there in the corner is Dean Haglund, best known for his role as Langley on X-Files. He's also been seen in the X-Files spinoff entitled The Lone Gunman. That's a great show.
Thank you so much.
And Dean is currently exploring comedy, inventing things, working on his comic books.
I have a comic book out, yes. That's
good
right.
For you.
I fancy myself a bit of a cartoonist.
Well, you know what? That is a very creative person who does it. Welcome.
Ooh,
thank you. Thank you for being here.
How do you like this festival, both of you?
Oh, my gosh. It's amazing.
It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I personally just went out on the bus tour over to the crash site.
I was going to say I did, too. It's absolutely the trip of a lifetime. It really
is. And it is 3 hours long.
Okay, we're going to take calls with both of you half hour as well. This time is going to fly by. But both of you are, I think, giants in the science fiction Hollywood field.
Wow.
And it's kind of neat to have you both here.
I've been on a diet, so I'm not trying to be a giant in the field.
And we are both blonde. So
yes, you are. Mm-hmm. When you were in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, did you have a good time doing that?
Oh, my gosh. It was an amazing experience, and it really still is because it brings us to this kind of event, and you meet people, you know, from all walks of life and in science fiction, science fact. I met a couple of real aliens today, too. So it was,
really?
Yeah, it's been a phenomenal experience
South
overall.
South of the border.
All of the above, baby.
I tell you, you've got a great fan base, Chase.
Oh, thanks.
Absolutely incredible. Some of them are calling already.
Wow.
Well, they are a loyal bunch, and I'm very thankful for that.
And of course, Dean, I have seen you at a couple conferences before, so you get into this stuff.
I get into this stuff. You know, as an actor, I was researching my role, and I played a conspiracy theorist, so I started meeting people like Dr. Roger Lear and Jordan Maxwell and having lunch with them and getting – their information that I could incorporate into my character. And now we've become good friends, so I often come to these conventions and hang out with them, and it's really cool.
All right, Richard, the scientist, what do you think of these two?
Notice
how his mouth is open and nothing is coming out of it, which is a first for Richard.
There is not a twit of confusion between Chase and Dean. I got to tell you that.
We look like brother and sister.
Scary. You can't take us anywhere.
That is true.
Yeah.
You do. You do have a
family. Often when we go to conventions together and we sit side by side.
From the planet Zeta Reticuli, both of you.
Oh, yeah, exactly. My favorite.
Let me ask Chase a question. Mm-hmm. Before you got into the Star Trek universe, did you understand what you were getting into in terms of people who really want that future?
You know, I actually did know the show quite well because, get this, I had a boyfriend who was such a Trekkie, that he only allowed me to call him during commercials.
Wow.
Okay?
Oh, my.
So, yeah.
Say something else. Only allowed me to call him Picard. That would have been really
nice. Well, there you go. Who's sorry now? No, but I did have a very strong familiarity, yes, with the show, and I love the show. But now, you know, really getting to see it firsthand, it's an entirely, you know, much richer, more intense experience. It's amazing. And you can't beat the loyalty of these folks and the fact that it brings you onto other projects, new films, things that crop up constantly.
When you auditioned for the part, did you have to do anything weird, funny accents or anything
like
that?
Yes, but I can't tell you here.
What?
No. George. I had a very different envisioning of my character, Lita, than the producers actually ended up going with. But it was something that I worked on extensively with cast members of Next Gen, just people that I knew and met, and I was like, what do I do to get on this show? It was actually the one show I prayed to be on, largely because I knew the fan base was so intense. Wow. and because the show was so quality.
Absolutely. And Dean, when you were doing X-Files.
Yes.
Great series. I wish it would continue.
Thank you.
I really would. It had its life.
Yeah.
But man, you must have had a great time doing
it. It was so much fun. It was a lot of work. I mean, we did 16-hour days. Every episode they shot to make it look like a feature film. The production values were through the roof. So it was a lot of hard work, but it was really a great time doing it.
Okay. My conspiratorial bent forces me to ask this question.
Please do.
How much of what you guys did was actually for real?
Well, here's the thing. The writers had an incredible library. When you went into the writer's office of Vince Gilligan or Frank Spotnitz, they didn't have the Sid Fields How to Write a Screenplay books. They had the religious rites of Mithra and the rare 16th century traits of Francis, right. bizarre stuff.
Pre-Da Vinci Code
stuff.
Did you ever see the episode where they tried to deal with a face on Mars?
I did.
The astronaut?
Yeah, space, wasn't
it? It was a space one. It was a space one. He was inhabited by this ghost that came.
And that was actually based on a lot of your work, I think, because Chris Carter had your book on the faces of Mars.
Did you know that, Richard?
No, but...
Did you not know that? But, that was in his office.
No, but let me tell you, the one night that Art had him on
was
the night that Mike Barra and I had published something on the show. We actually did a commentary, and it's on the web, enterprisemission.com. It's there, and I think it's labeled X-Files something or other.
Right.
It's the one time that Carter called Art and demanded he be allowed on the show the next night.
Oh.
And Art sent me, called me up and said, send in some questions, which I did.
Yes, you did.
And Carter answered the question, is this for real? And he talked about how certain intel people will come up to him and say, how can you be so close? So I didn't know specifically he had monuments on the shelf, but I got to tell you, X-Files is now like Star Trek. The sun never sets on X-Files.
Right.
So you can see a rerun anytime, day or night, 24/7 on your local satellite channel. I was watching the Face on Mars episode because initially I was very put off by it. It would not have been what I would have done, even in the strictly entertainment mode.
Right.
And I'm watching, and suddenly there's a close-up on a digital clock where a key plot point of the shuttle mission surviving. Mm-hmm. And I said, holy cow, he knows, because the close-up was 19 hours, 50 minutes. 19.5.
Let's take a pause. Now watch this great technology. I mean, here we are in Roswell, New Mexico.
Roswell.
I push a button and go. You're on Coast to Coast, west of the Rockies. Hi there.
Well, hello. How you
you doing today?
We're well. Who's your question for? Go ahead, take it away. And where are you calling from?
My question is for the Star Trek or the Star Trek character.
Hey,
Star Trek character.
I forgot. Character.
That would be Chase.
That would be Chase.
Okay, I have all the movies of Star Trek. I have the Deep Space Nine, and this is the first time in my life I've ever gone on coast to coast.
Well, congratulations. Me too.
I mean, I recorded that way back when before they canceled it all. On the last battle of Deep Space Nine.
Okay, well, thank you.
It is damn cool. I love it.
All right, hey, where are you calling from, and do you have a question?
Yeah, San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
I was going to say, do you think that the technology today that you showed back then is showing right now, like on all the computers and
all
everything
right, else? That's a good question. Chase, all that technology you had in the show,
well, absolutely.
Do you think we've got it now?
I absolutely know that there have been so many things that, you know, that Gene Roddenberry only dreamed of and that are, you know, currently in our technology today. And I can only hope that we'll, you know, continue to have those things and discover those things. I mean, wouldn't it be great to get to go into warp drive or, you know, I think that those things are certainly inspiring to physicists and scientists.
Have you heard about the light machine?
What's the light machine?
The light machine is an LED device, computer program that looks right, like something right out of McCoy's sick bay.
Okay.
It's being used by the Air Force, by the Army, by the Marines, by the Navy, by NASA in the space station and the shuttle. And Robin and I have one.
What do you mean you have one?
We have one. And what you do is if you have a problem.
We want one.
I want one.
If you have a sprain. If you're coming down with a cold,
If
you have a lung infection, mm-hmm. if you are bitten by an insect, a huge range of maladies are amenable because this thing is a computer-controlled frequency pulser.
Is this like Edgar Cayce talked about a long time ago about ultraviolet light?
No. This is more like Royal Rife.
Well, I'm calling Dr. Bashir this one because this sounds really cool.
But it's a Rife machine with infrared and visible technology,
right.
Not radio frequencies.
Oh, I see.
But it would be so familiar in McCoy's sick bay.
Right.
It is an absolutely quintessential demonstration of how Gene's vision has now come true.
How big is this machine?
It's palm size.
That's where did you get it?
Yeah.
Robin can tell you. After the show.
But now I heard that in the U.S. they were going to outlaw any cures that require
audio.
They're working on that.
Yep. If it's not FDA approved,
if it's not a pharmaceutical thing, that they were not going to allow that anymore. Are you holding an illegal cure?
No, I believe this is FDA approved.
It is.
It's not like under the wire.
No.
I'm not sure. Okay, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there. Where are you calling from?
Hi, George. This is Amy from Chicago.
Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Well, I have a little question for Chase. First of all,
I want
to agree with Dean that the production values on both X-Files and anything Star Trek were absolutely amazing.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
It's fabulous stuff.
We worked hard to get that.
Yeah, slaving day and night.
Yeah.
No, thank you, Amy. We agree. It's not every actor that gets to be on such a quality show in every way. It's
true.
A major blessing.
True.
Absolutely. Any idea if there's going to be a DS9 movie or another incarnation of Star Trek coming up?
Alas, there will not be a DS9 movie.
What?
That's something that,
I hate to break the news.
Travesty.
You know, I mean, I think that the writers and pretty much the cast, but mostly the writer-producers, just decided when the show was over that it had really run its course, and mm-hmm. it certainly could have gone longer. I mean, when we stopped at the end of 7 seasons, we were the number one syndicated show in the world, I'm sure X-Files was, wasn't it?
Number two.
I think that there is a general consensus that there has been a little too much Star Trek as of late. I mean, I think the fan base has really been inundated.
A little oversaturated.
I think so. And, you know,
Enterprise screwed it up for everyone.
Well, pretty much, but we don't have to talk about that.
Just saying.
So with the new movie coming out, I think, you know, they're unfortunately making a huge effort to mainstream that, I believe. And I'm just hoping that they don't really alienate the core fan base, because they really should, I think, pay attention to the loyalty that's there. And I hope that they stay true
to... Well, Gene was on to something.
What?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You know, the old axiom, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Pretty much, yeah.
And then Enterprise, I'm sorry, felt like they broke it.
Well, and I think that really science fiction fans generally have an eye for, I think they have integrity in terms of the content of their shows, and I think that's what they insist upon.
And
so
they're
very critical,
Chase, aren't they?
I believe so, and well, they should be, because, I mean, sci-fi, having the ability to speak to people in such allegorical ways doesn't need to be, you know, it doesn't need to be, you know, a trashy,
by the way,
too sexy show in space.
You two are what's good about Hollywood. By the way,
aww.
You really are.
Thank you, George. So are you.
No, you really do. You make it a delight. You know, so many people who are actors and actresses, you get this stigma of who they are, and here you are. You're with people. You're giving back. And I know Chase is involved in charities. Dean, you're doing all kinds of things. You're good people first and foremost.
Thank you.
And that's so
Thank
important.
You. That's
well,
nice.
How many jerks from Hollywood do you get on this show, George?
And do you tell them that they're
too
jerks?
Many, too many. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, we got another jerk from Hollywood.
Part of the epitome of Hollywood.
I had Pat Boone, but I didn't call him a jerk.
you know, George. Picking up on what you just said, the thing that makes Chase and Dean different is they got into the spirit of the concept of the writer and the creator of the show.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when you have actors that can immerse themselves in that world and make that world as much of a reality as the world we all live in, mm-hmm. that's when you can sell the message. Remember, was it Barnum who said, don't, if you have a message.
P.T. Barnum?
Yeah.
Barnum?
Yeah. If you have a message to send, send a telegram, don't make a movie.
Right, Samuel.
Right.
Gene Roddenberry had a message. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very privileged to know him at a very early age, and he was one of those extraordinary showmen that could encapsulate his message in an entertaining surround, get actors of your caliber and quality to see the vision.
Yeah.
That's why I asked you, Chase, about did you understand what you were getting into? And your answer satisfied me that, yeah, you kind of got that thing that makes and made Star Trek unique. And it was the first show, as I remember, that actually had fans stand up to networks and say, you're not going to take it off the air.
Absolutely.
And NBC was forced to put it back on the air because of the fan reaction.
Now, Chase, I understand you've brought us a little present here.
I have indeed.
Play, but I want you. I've got about 45 seconds for you to kind of set the stage of your other career.
Thanks very much. Well, actually, a film that I'm in, which will be out early next year, is called Yesterday Was a Lie, and I sing four songs in that. And as a prelude to that, which I consider to be about the peak of my career so far. I'm very excited about it. I did two CDs. One is called Thrill of the Chase.
Yes.
And there's also another CD called Ad Astra. We sell them on my website at chaseclub.com. And we raise a lot of money for charity. Right now we're...
Good for you. And we're live at the UFO Festival in Roswell, New Mexico. Richard C. Hoagland, he beamed himself aboard, and he's co-hosting with me. Richard, who's behind the secret door right now?
An old friend, James Jordan Maxwell, who I've known, we were calculating before, since 1991. It doesn't seem that long. He's probably the preeminent researcher and independent scholar in the field of the occult and religious philosophies. Jordan knows more about the occult and the political reasoning behind the occult, particularly in terms of certain things going on in this government, than almost anybody that I can think of, and I can't think of anybody else, so he's probably, as Aldrin used to say, number one on the runway. He served for 3.5 years as the religion editor of Truth Seeker magazine, which is America's oldest free thought journal, and his work in exploring the hidden foundations of Western religions and secret societies creates extraordinary responses from audiences around the world, and what he's going to talk to you about tonight is going to be another one of those high data points. Jordan?
Hey, Jordan, good to have you back. And I've got to tell you, Richard, Jordan is such a friend of Coast to Coast. When he heard that I was going to go ahead with this Ouija board experiment, and he'll address that here in a second, he sent me probably one of the most elaborate emails I've read in a long time, warning me not to do it. But I'll tell you how much class he has. Knowing how bullheaded I am and that I'm going to go ahead and do this, he's going to be in the studio with me. Thanks, Jordan.
Well, I'm honoring your request because I have such a high regard for your person.
I feel much better, George, that he's going to be there.
Yeah, and Rosemary Ellen Guiley will be there.
Because I am not a fan of this idea.
I know it.
Of all the ideas you've had, you know.
And many of them have been brilliant.
Do you want me to be very, very honest?
Sure.
I think this is the dumbest idea you have ever come up with, bar none. And the reason I say that is because I'm not an occultist, but I'm a physicist. And there is a science here. There's a hyper-dimensional science that I've now got decades of database from the Russians on. And what I'm concerned about is that you're going to open a gate. And I understand why you're doing it, I think. And I understand your position that it's the board is a toy. It's who's doing it. But the factor that I don't think you've taken into account is that you're going to do this for millions of people. And if you look at a bell curve, if you look at, you know, the classic population differentiation, most of those people are going to be okay.
You can't talk me out of this.
I'm not trying to. What I'm trying to do is to inform the audience of my apprehensions. And the apprehensions are based on the physics, that there are those people in that audience on that night who may not have the intentions that you and the majority of the audience will have.
Jordan, how come you felt so strongly, one, to be there, and two, to tell me not to do it?
Because for 46 years, I have involved myself in the world of the occult. And if there's one thing I understand is the darkness of the spirit world. And I am totally convinced that the Ouija board, with all due respect, represents the darkest force that you can bring to your home and bring into your life.
If I tell you this, and I kind of hinted about it yesterday on the program, if I, in a near-death experience, which not even my staff knows about yet, because I haven't told anybody, that occurred 7 years ago, if I saw something that I must see if it's going to be there again, would you feel a little differently about this?
No, I don't think so.
You wouldn't?
I think that I am totally sure that with what Richard said, I would agree with. I, you know, it's your privilege to do what you wish, and I am honored that you would want me with you. But I do believe that what you...
If they come out and grab me, they're going to grab you first. That's why I want you there.
And I was kind of concerned about that, yeah. Because the board might end up talking to me. And
they'll take the big guy before they get to me. Believe me.
And, but anyway, I think that it will be very interesting. But see, when you're opening up yourself to what I would call the dark side, what you're doing is opening up the whole listening world to the dark side.
We'll find out. When you were with me for a full program some time ago, you disappeared right there at
this
the bottom.
This was back in 2005.
Yeah, yeah. You disappeared. You were gone.
Yes.
Something happened.
The telephone company shut my phone off.
While you were on the air with
while
us.
I was on
the
air.
National broadcast.
Yes.
Why?
Well, obviously, because of what I happened by chance to be talking about. And I would like to tell you tonight the rest of the story.
Okay, I got a couple minutes left. Go ahead.
Because
then we got to Roger Lear.
I got shut off the telephone. I was being interviewed by you.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, the phone went dead. And when it went dead, a few seconds later, I held on to see if maybe there was just something wrong with the line. It came back alive. And I heard people walking around inside of an office.
Oh,
and they're talking to each
other. I never knew that.
Oh, yes.
That's why you've been wanting to get to me.
Absolutely. Because there was a guy in there talking with some others, and his words were, somebody's going to have to deal with this guy. And that scared me because I knew this was government. Only government has the opportunity to tell the telephone company, shut this phone now. And when it went down, I heard a man walking around. You could hear him walking around an office, and he said to someone else, somebody's going to have to deal with this guy. And that's scary, hearing a government guy saying something like that. And then all of a sudden, somebody said, a line, something about the line.
They they knew it was still up.
Like it was still
and
up.
And then, right, and they hung it up.
Unbelievable. There's more on this to come. Jordan, thanks for dropping in behind
the
green door.
Thank you very much.
Stay safe, my friend.
There'll be more of Jordan Maxwell, and of course, he'll be with me on July 25th when we do this Ouija board experiment for that entire program. Up next, Dr. Roger Lear. We'll see what's new with him with alien implants on Coast to Coast AM. What an absolutely fast night tonight in Roswell, New Mexico, where my car is double parked, but I don't care because the police here like me, and I won't get a ticket. It could be, too. Anyways, Richard C. Hoagland, introduce our next special guest.
To my left, all you radio folks out there in Radio Land, is Dr. Roger Lear. Roger is a very good friend and went through something like I went through, a little bit of a ticker problem. He is the author of Aliens and the Scalpel and 8 additional books on alien implants and the UFO subject, which has been one of the most important leaders in the physical evidence research involving ufology. I mean, ultimately, UFOs have got to involve physical evidence, and Roger has been at the cutting edge, sorry about that, Roger, in getting to
very,
that evidence,
very good, Richard.
Which he will talk to you about in a moment. He and his team have now, I think it's been, what, 13 surgeries that you've done on the subject?
13, the last one just a short time ago.
Okay. They have removed something like 14 separate and distinct objects that are suspected on grounds that he will obviously talk about of being real physical alien implants. They have been investigated scientifically by some of the most prestigious laboratories in the world, and the findings have baffled, and the comparisons have been made to some meteorite samples, which I'm sure Roger will tell us about. Dr. Lear is currently working on a major motion picture entitled Earth's Original Sin. Roger?
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, George, for having me on the show.
Absolutely.
Well, I suppose you want to know what's new.
Yes. When you mentioned a new operation, who was it, what was it, and what did you find?
Well, it was just done a couple of weeks ago, a gentleman in his 60s with an object in the knee. And he had quite a good history of abduction experiences. Those types are described by Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs almost right down to the T. He even had a memory that one morning he woke up in bed after having a very strange dream and found a drop of blood on his knee. So he looked, and he didn't find any injury. There wasn't any portal of entry, and he couldn't find any irritation. The skin wasn't a different color. There was no sign of an obvious scar. So,
but there was a fresh drop of blood.
A fresh drop of blood. So he wiped it off and wondered what was going on. Well, he began to have a little discomfort, a superficial discomfort in the knee. And by the time he finally contacted me, which was some years after this happened, he was having some difficulty in the superficial skin because as you move the knee, of course, the skin and the tissues underneath move. So every time he moved the knee, why, he would have some discomfort. So he contacted me, and he was one of the few individuals who was already prepared. Because,
you mean psychologically?
No, he was prepared physically because he had looked at my website.
He knew what to do.
He knew what to do. So upon initial telephone contact, when I asked him, which I usually do, of patients who think they may have an object in your body, do you have an X-ray? He said, yes. I not only have an X-ray, but I also have an MRI.
And you're saying, thank you,
so,
God.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Please send them to me. I gave him the address, and he was very compliant. Sent them along, and we took them to our radiologists who looked at it and said, yes, there is a definitive object, and told us where in the knee that it was. So one of the suggestions that was made.
And how deeply embedded was it?
We couldn't tell from the initial X-ray just how deep it was because an X-ray projects the object, so it could be at any level in any area.
So it was just one X-ray from one angle.
It was two angles, which showed that there was an object there, but you can't say exactly what its placement is because the X-ray beam itself projects it into tissue farther than it is.
Well, how do you get something like that, Roger?
Well,
you have to dig away at the knee?
I hope not, George. I hope not, George. You remember that show, of course.
You're scaring me.
So what we did was we asked him to get a CAT scan done. Now, a CAT scan is different because it can pinpoint the exact area and the measurement of the object right down to a gnat P piece of a millimeter.
Okay.
So we did that, and he was very compliant, had the CAT scan done. He sent us the CAT scan. The gentleman lives in Colorado, but has relatives and a mother who lived in San Diego. We sent him in the interim a whole packet full of questions, which is part of our routine criteria and protocols. And then we graded the possibility of whether he was an abductee, and he came out.
How big was the object?
The object was about a little over a centimeter in length and about maybe as thick as a pencil lead.
That's large.
Yeah, it was a pretty good size object. So we got the grading done, and that showed us that he had about a 63% possibility of actually being an abductee. So here's a pretty good chance that the guy is telling you a true story and of his involvement. Mm-hmm. He had a number of different incidents which he remembered consciously. We don't allow these individuals who undergo hypnotic regression prior to having a surgical procedure done, basically because we don't want the criticism that, oh, you guys put, you know, crazy ideas in the guy's head.
Right. You're so leading him.
Leading him, whatever. So we try and do this as scientifically as possible. Because as you know, I'm just the messenger. If you don't like the message, you know, don't kill the messenger. So we did all that, and then we got him to come back to California. He came up for an initial interview. And at the time he came up, we did a number of superficial examinations using, one, a Gauss meter, in which we got a 4 milligauss field coming out of the area. And then we used a radio frequency detector lock, and we also detected a radio frequency.
Like an RFID chip.
Right. So we wrote down it's a complex megahertz frequency, which I did not bring. Mm-hmm. I knew you would ask.
So when you ping it, it pings back.
Yeah. So with this data and with the photographic and other data that we had, we went on and we went ahead and scheduled the surgery. Now, one of the things that we were lacking for this particular case is the ability to go ahead and do this definitively without using an expensive assistive device called a C-arm. So we had to figure out a way without doing what you were suggested doing before, digging a hole in this man, looking at it for an extended period.
Ruining his knee.
So we came up with a joint idea between the surgeon, the radiologist, and myself that right prior to the surgery, we're going to send him back to X-ray, and we'll do a limited CAT scan in which the radiologist will mark the exact
area where
it is.
So that will be done.
That was done.
Was done.
And then he immediately went from there. We went into surgery.
So you did get it.
We got it. We took it out. And
what does it look like?
And what is it?
It looked exactly like the other five rods that I had taken out, which were little metallic rods covered with this very strange gray biological coating.
And you have no idea what they are.
We know what they're made of. We have a theory as to what they could possibly be and what they do.
What's the theory?
The theory is that they are devices for gaining information that has something to do with the human body. They're not tracking devices. They're not behavioral altering devices. But it's a device for learning something that's going on in the body.
Maybe environmental change and they want to monitor something?
It's possible that they are devices for environmental change. But my particular pet theory, based on what we've learned from children today, some people call them millennium children, star children, indigo children. I think that the human race is undergoing possibly a mass genetic manipulation. These devices will tell somebody, some intelligence, what progress has been made along those lines.
Let's take a call before we have to say goodnight to you, Roger. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Dan. Pick it up. There you go. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was in my living room one night, and
I had a strange dream, and I saw these 4-foot aliens. They lifted me up in the air, levitated me, and they were sticking silver metallic tools in my orifices, every orifice.
And are these materials there now?
I don't know. That's what I want to find out, if they stuck an implant in me.
All right, Roger, how does somebody... No, I guess he does what this individual has done, and that is go and get it checked.
Correct, George. If there's any suspicion that you have an object in your body, it shouldn't belong there. Go to a physician and get an X-ray taken. If there's something there that doesn't belong there, and the physician agrees, you're welcome to get in touch with me and send me the film.
Roger's working on a major motion picture entitled Earth's Original Sin. His website, well, you can find the link at coasttocoastam.com, but it is alienscalpel.com. That's a scary website address.
Mm-hmm.
Alienscalpel.com.
Well, George, you know me. I don't scare you, do I?
Yeah, with those fang teeth of yours.
Oh, that's my dentist. Blame my dentist.
I'm sorry. Those are your teeth.
Yes. That's my natural look.
We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie here at Roswell, New Mexico, where Richard C. Hoagland and I will go out tomorrow morning and look for old Mac Brazel's farm and see if we can find any pieces.
You know, I've got a story there for you. Remember how I talked about before we came down to do this, I wanted you to get here a few hours earlier?
Well, I did the best I could.
Robin and I, when we were here last time, were taken to a place where I think some pieces are buried.
What do you mean you think?
There are many times when I don't talk about things because I'm afraid that the bad guys will zip in and a vacuum, a race, and whatever.
Ah, okay.
There is here in Roswell, a few miles away from where we're sitting tonight, in front of all these nice people out behind the glass.
And you live in New Mexico, so you know this like the back of your hand, generally.
It's a big country.
It is a big
huge country. We found a site which is, I don't want to even describe it unless you and I agree that we're going to keep the spotlight on this, because I think what they did when they vacuumed up, according to Hout's memo, they vacuumed the field several times, you know, shoulder
kept
to shoulder
going back.
And knee to knee.
Yep.
They went back and back and back to pick up every little tiny piece.
Yep.
I think we found where they buried them. I don't think they trucked them away.
Why would they bury them?
Because it's the safest thing to do. You bury them.
Is this your theory?
We have evidence.
All right, we'll talk about that.
And if it's true, and we could bring a crew... We can bring a crew to look at this, put the spotlight on. We can keep it from disappearing. So I don't want to say anything more, except I think I may know where some of these pieces are buried. Remember what Tom Carey said the other night?
Mm-hmm.
The holy grail of the Roswell incident is to find some pieces of the wreck.
Absolutely.
We may have a lead on where some of those pieces are buried.
All right. Who's the dapper gentleman on your left?
He is Richard M. Dolan. And as you said, he is a heavy hitter. He was born in Brooklyn in New York in 1962. God, that makes me feel a bit old. Holds an M.A. in history from the University of Rochester. Calm down, Richard. Calm down. B.A. in history from Alfred University and a certificate in political theory from Oxford University. In 2000, Richard published a 500-page study, you really ought to read this, everyone, called UFOs and the National Security State. This is the first volume of a two-part historical narrative of the national security dimensions of the UFO phenomenon from 1941 to the present. Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut, has called Dolan's book, UFOs and the National Security State, monumental, while Hal Puthoff, director of the Institute for Advanced Studies in Austin, has declared it to be a must-read for serious students in the field, and I can only say that I would... echo that sentiment profoundly. Richard, welcome
Thank
to the
you.
Show.
Thank you so very
Do
much.
Do you two
Richard.
Know each other? Have you met before?
No.
Well, briefly. We had met at a conference, but not
We've
really.
Had more interesting, intense discussion here while you were doing whatever you do over there, because I'm going to run a live-fire question past Richard neither one of you have been briefed on. Tonight, Nightline, which has not been known for courage in this area, ran segments of Out of the Blue. you know, Ted Koppel's right. imprimatur.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the Blue is, as everyone in this audience should know, if they don't, probably the best documentary produced on this subject in the last, what, 10, 20, 30
it's
years?
It's outstanding.
Outstanding. The fact that they're not ridiculing, as we're on the air tonight live, that they're running coast to coast on the ABC network, mm-hmm. television network, a serious, hard-hitting, factual documentary reinforces the reason that I'm here. You remember, I don't do UFOs.
You don't do UFOs. You don't believe when that we've been visited.
No, no, I never said that. No, the reason I don't do UFOs is because I can't make the evidence stand still, which segues into my question. Richard, right. as this political expert to my left.
And by the way, I have interviewed Richard Dolan for a number of years.
Yes.
I'm going to sit back and enjoy this discussion. I'm going to pretend I'm in the audience. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go in the audience. Tom knows when I'm supposed to be back. I'm going to go out there with the number of people who are listening to this program and watch them and talk with them while you interview Richard Dolan. Because I want to hear what you two have to say.
Can you let me do the commercial breaks and things like
that? Oh, no, I'll be back in time for that. Right. Then you're getting into my pocket.
The network.
Go ahead.
The key thing I wanted to ask you, Richard, is this is now the 60th anniversary.
Right.
The event that we're commemorating tonight happened in 1947, 60 years ago, as I've been saying, the tetrahedral anniversary. Are we coming up on some kind of a political breakthrough? Is this moment kind of like the defining moment in this extraordinary turgid history of denial, 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 cover up, cover up, cover up, lie upon lie upon lie? Can you tonight give us an assessment that maybe, just maybe, there is light at the end of this tunnel and it's not the headlight of an oncoming train?
I think in the long term, let's say within a decade, that there's going to be light at the end of this tunnel. I have been skeptical for a number of years that there's going to be a kind of imminent political disclosure about the reality of UFOs. And the only reason I feel this way is that I think that sometimes people underestimate the pressures on the secret keepers themselves to try to keep a hold of this. I mean, what's happening increasingly is that you've got two very powerful forces. You have the forces of change. We are in radical revolutionary change in our civilization right now. I mean, the technology that we're living in 2007, it's almost incomprehensible even by the standards of 20 years ago. And I think that that will continue to change.
And when you say technology, are you talking about technology?
Talking about computers, talking about interconnection,
transfer,
web.
The limitations of rights, privacy, things
well,
like that?
I was actually talking about the technological changes and development of the web, I think, are creating forces that secret keepers were not anticipating a couple of generations ago. Now, there are opposite political forces. I mean, there's absolutely, in my view, the forces of kind of a political global police state that, on a transnational basis, I think, is seeking to impose itself. I see the legal revolution in the United States over the last 6 years as part of that process to kind of transform our culture and indeed global culture to be under kind of a different, possibly more repressive sort of political order.
Eavesdropping without warrants.
Exactly.
Like that.
But there are different forces at play. And there are cultural changes that have been taking place along in UFO belief systems. I mean, my feeling is I'm noticing a much greater sense of openness, even here in the United States, on this topic of UFOs. And I'm really wondering, regarding the ABC treatment of Out of the Blue that you were just referring to, I do suspect that there's a kind of a cultural sea change that may be taking place.
Do you remember the Jennings special before Peter so tragically died?
Yes, I do.
Know, and the reaction from the, and I'll divide them from the believers who were furious at how the subject was dealt with.
It was a disappointment, in my opinion.
To the hardcore, it's got to come out tomorrow kind of thing.
Right.
But did not you see a foreshadowing in that the program was divided into segments where the first segment was serious? And they only trivialized
right.
it in the second half.
Well, I may say I predicted this well before it happened. And I said basically they're going to inflate the balloon for the first half and they're going to deflate it in the second half.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they did.
I thought it was a disappointing effort, actually, and I don't want to speak negatively about any of the people who were involved in it, but it was my own feeling that it could have been far, far better done.
But keep in mind the audience. I mean, you and I and everyone who listens to the show, we basically eat, breathe, and sleep this
stuff. Yeah, we're into it. But what I find
whereas
is
ABC is dealing with a mainstream audience
right.
for whom Roswell is as ancient
right.
as their great-grandmother.
Here's what I find. Okay, I have one-on-one discussions with people all the time about this topic. They find out that I'm this UFO writer, and they ask me questions. And what I discover is that people don't have a lot of knowledge on this topic, but there's a real hunger for that knowledge. And when they find out that this topic cuts very deep, they want more. And I think that what's happened is if you feed a child junk food their whole life and then you give them a plate of broccoli, they're like, you know, what is this you're giving me? But that, in fact, if you give people good information on this topic, people are starting to realize that there's a big disconnect between their official version of reality, what they're told about what's going on in this world.
Not just in the UFO area.
Not just UFOs. I think in all aspects that there's something not right. And they hunger for something that's going to answer some of those questions. And when they find out that there's very possibly this UFO cover-up, I think people want to know more about it. So I think that ABC had an opportunity, I think it was in 2003, when that – was that 2003 when that
yeah.
changed?
Yeah.
And it could have been better. It could have been worse, but it could have been better. Regarding what's going on now, the political situation, just to answer your original question – I certainly don't see it coming from the current presidential administration, absolutely not. And I don't see it coming from a subsequent administration. I think that unless there's a crisis, some huge
event,
absolutely undeniable.
Don't you see some dots here that are kind of interesting? I mean, look what happened. We had Paul Hellyer,
right.
who was not a non-entity. You know, we used to call those, when I worked for Cronkite, trial balloons.
Right.
You know, you run up the flagpole and see who salutes was the old Madison Avenue thing. Hellyer was greeted not with derision, but with respect in many quarters. People were listening because, you know, the former defense minister of Canada
right.
is not somebody you can dismiss lightly. Then you have the Hout memo. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to ask you an off-the-wall question. Is it possible that we're dealing not with the kind of chance of political fortunes, but a long-term plan? I find it remarkable that the Hout memo comes out in the 60th year of Roswell. And the reason I find it remarkable is because these numbers, this numerology, mm-hmm. we find in many other areas of government operation, particularly in NASA, which is part of the new book on NASA that I'm going to release this fall. Is it possible that Hout's careful memo was designed to be released this year on this anniversary to initiate the next phase of someone's long-range plan?
Well, when we say release, we have to ask, release by whom?
Well, it was ostensibly commissioned because he thought he was dying.
Right.
He was putting it away for the future. Everyone has said it was to be released only on the occasion of his death.
Right.
But how do we know? I mean, I was listening the other night when
well, you seem to be implying, though, that it's beyond the decision of his immediate family. That
yes,
it's
exactly. It's like the Colonel Corso book that had mm-hmm. the foreword by Strom Thurmond,
right.
who then said, wait a minute, I didn't read that darn thing. I don't
right.
know. And
exactly.
take it out of there. But it passed the smell test. In other words, everybody who read it because of Strom Thurmond, you can't take back that they read it because of Strom Thurmond. So if you're looking at time-release aspirin, I mean, let me cut to the chase. There's a document that we found as part of our work called the Brookings Report,
mm-hmm.
which was commissioned by NASA in 1959
right.
by the prestigious think tank. And it basically said that there would require a period of acculturization, that you'd have to basically get everybody kind of in sync to the idea we're not alone. And it would take maybe a couple generations, mm-hmm. including educational programs, informational transfers, television shows, movies, radio, whatever. In other words, what I guess I'm asking is us sitting here tonight discussing Roswell with all these thousands of people milling around this town with a much more serious approach by mainstream media, ergo the ABC, you know, airing of that
Indeed.
Special
okay.
tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hout memo, are you maybe a little bit shall we say, negative in terms of what might happen the next year or two or three or four.
Well, yes, I think that my opinion is probably here in Roswell this weekend considered more negative than most, because I just don't see a disclosure happening. And actually, I have to honestly say that I don't see this as part of a concerted effort at disclosure. I could be wrong, and I reserve the right to be wrong in the future. I've been wrong about things in the past, so it wouldn't be the first time.
I don't see
the political powers as actually having control in this issue. My sources that I talk to, some of them are very well connected, have indicated to me again and again that the real power is actually beyond government and is privately held, and that actually it's hard to determine which government players, including the president, have really authority over this issue.
But if I'm right, if there was a long-term plan formulated in 1947 that was extra-governmental, you know, it has often been said presidents come and go, but the bureaucracy
remains, right.
You know, then the timetable I'm referring to is not by the people we elect at all.
Well, I won't argue that vociferously against you. I mean, we have to wait and see. I'm not totally persuaded.
Are you willing to be surprised?
I would be surprised if a disclosure, an open disclosure, happened anytime soon. Soon, I mean within the next 5 years.
Okay.
Now, having said that, I fervently believe that it's going to happen.
The next 5 years.
2012.
2012.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
I do think that it will happen, and as I say, I think the pace of change in our society is going to just force it to happen, because we are living in such revolutionary times. One thing I've noticed in my study of the last few decades is that periods of major political change, regime change, other countries have often led to some serious disclosures about UFOs. Think back to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Think back to the death of Franco in Spain in 1975, the death of Mao in China in the 70s. Our own Watergate crisis wasn't a regime change, but it did really lead to a major release of UFO documentation. I think what happens is when there's a serious political crisis, and we are headed toward it in this country right now, that there are opportunities, that there are always people on the inside, let us say, who are looking for an opportunity to let this information out and to facilitate it, let us say. So I do think that there are some opportunities here. So I guess I'll amend my negativism by saying that if the stuff gets real bad in the next couple of years, which it could, then something very major could, let's say, leak out.
So you're looking at that as a diversion. You would say they would leak this material?
No, I think that the leak would occur by opportunists within.
By dissident factions within.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I think that's a possibility.
See, the wild card that I've always held is very important and completely ignored by the UFO community is the ruins factor. There are stunning things on the moon, on Mars,
right,
on the outer satellites that NASA has photographed. We will be releasing some of these amazing images this fall.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this too. And let me add on, because you're right, because UFO researchers don't do Mars very much. They don't talk about the moon. When I started researching this a few years ago, I will confess I wasn't up to speed on a lot of the work that you're doing. I'd heard about you, and I said, well, I have to catch up on Hoagland stuff. And I remembered chatting with a rather senior scientist, well-connected guy, about the Mars and about anomalies. And I was somewhat lighthearted, and he wrote back quickly and said, don't be lighthearted about this. A lot of us are looking at this.
Thanks.
I think that the anomalies on Mars may actually be a motivation for a secret space program, which I happen to believe is a real possibility.
And I'm in agreement there, and we'll kick it back to George because we're out of time.
Great job, both of you. It's like watching Duel of the Titans.
Except we're on the same side.
Yes, you are.
That's
absolutely
right. We are.
You know, if I were a governmental agent, I would hate to have to go against you two.
Well, thank you, George.
That's why Phil Plait will not debate us, you know.
Well, that's true, too. That's true, too. You know, Richard, we've got one more guest coming in and also a surprise door guest that we'll talk to for a couple of minutes. But a dear friend of mine, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, will join us in a second. But, Richard, give us your website, would you, sir?
Sure. It's keyholepublishing.com, just like looking through a keyhole, keyholepublishing.com.
What is on the other side of the keyhole, Richard?
The truth.
I like that.
The truth.
Sounds like a movie.
Is immutable, and it exists independent of what we want it to be. Richard, and it's our job to look for it.
You've always been a gracious guest on Coast to Coast, and we appreciate you. I think we're getting close to disclosure. You feel it?
Hey, that's kind of what I think.
Yeah, okay. I'll say yes. I'll say yes. That's I want it to be yes.
Steve Bassett laughing in the background there while we said that. Well, we are. Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We are live at the UFO Festival here in Roswell, New Mexico, and we will be back with a surprise door guest who just came through the door, so he's not too much of a surprise to us here. And then Rosemary Ellen Guiley joins us as we get her take on ETs, and then we'll take some questions with her, so get ready. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Okay, those numbers are for Rosemary Ellen Guiley. She'll be with us in just a second to talk about ETs, shadow people as well. But we've got a surprise behind the door guest. Well, actually, not a surprise because he opened the door before anybody had a chance to let him in. Stephen Bassett from the X Conference. Hey, Stephen, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Always great to be with you, George.
You Hi, Stephen. You are very busy these days. What have you been up to?
Well, I'm back engaging the U.S. Congress and the political media in Washington, D.C., trying to get them to end the truth embargo. And if I may take a moment, I would also like to reserve the right to say that Richard Dolan is wrong.
Okay.
No problem.
Right. On the record.
Yeah.
So what's your time frame?
I believe that the Democrats are planning disclosure in the first months of the next administration, which they're fairly confident they're going to win. Mm-hmm. I did a little stint on Fox News this morning. Activism takes many forms.
Absolutely.
And this was a very cool one. I did 3 minutes, Fox and Friends, which is kind of a, you know,
well,
young
it's
hippie show.
A good clip.
It's cool, but it's cool. It's Fox News. Yep.
It's Fox.
And they're good on this issue. So I did 3 minutes, and I told them what I was going to talk about. I want to talk about the ET ticket, which is the most likely, the best ticket, rather, amongst both parties, two people, in service of the disclosure issue. And the producer read my article, which is out in UFO Magazine. It's going to be in Fate, and it's all over the place. So they read the article. And so they asked me the question right off the bat, and I went into them and explained why I believe that the most best ET ticket is Hillary Clinton and Bill Richardson. Mm-hmm. It also happens to be the most likely ticket that will emerge from either party predicting now. Hillary and Bill Richardson. In fact, Richardson's running for vice president.
Yeah,
I had no monitor.
That's a consensus.
Everybody knows that in Washington. No. I had no monitor, so I didn't find out until later that the entire time that I'm doing this, they had put Hillary's picture up and Bill Richardson's picture up with the word UFO
All
between
right.
them.
And you're speaking, you don't know it.
Yeah. Let me tell you something. That is going to tweak some people at the Democratic National
that
Committee.
Is very
okay.
Fascinating.
It is not the kind of thing they want to see. Because I think there are plans to disclose in the administration, but they would prefer to be able to do it after they get elected without actually having to say anything about it on the way. Exactly.
Maybe they'll let you say it first.
Well, look, here's the deal. I'm not going to let up.
Well, remember, in Washington, the name of the game is plausible deniability.
Stephen Bassett has been pounding away at this for years.
You put Stephen out there. You put him on the right-wing channel, Fox, which everyone knows is right-wing. He then provides this frame. And then you do polling, and you see what happens.
Yeah.
And there's total plausible deniability.
What's up next at your X conference, and when will it be?
We've got the third one scheduled for September 14 through 16 at the Hilton Gaithersburg. Extraordinary lineup of insider-type people. This is where I'm going now. Insiders, people that have been dealing from the inside out, and people investigating the insiders. We've got some very special people lined up that may be coming in at the last minute. It will be in the middle of the campaign season. All of the presidential candidates will be invited to come or send a staffer. All the members of Congress will be invited or send a staffer. And we will, again, bring the issue to Washington and place it underneath their nose so if they have a moment of their time to spare, they might come on down and find out what's going on. That's what the conference is
Stephen,
about.
Thanks for dropping in.
Always a pleasure.
We'll
Thank
be
you.
Back with Rosemary Ellen Guiley on Coast to Coast AM. Well, she's been a guest of mine. Gosh, almost since the beginning of time, but she's not that old. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, PhD, expert on paranormal, visionary, spiritual topics. She's written well over 31 books. She's looked at shadow people. And Rosemary, what the heck are you doing at a UFO festival?
I've always been interested in UFOs, George. It's part of everything that I deal with in the occult and the paranormal. And my research in shadow people shows a very interesting connection to ETs.
Oh, really?
It does,
Tell me this correlation.
It's kind of the newest wrinkle, because I've been studying shadow people for over 2 years now, as you know, and you've helped me do it by making announcements on the air. And I began to notice a lot of similarities between shadow people and other kinds of phenomena, particularly men in black and the abducting ETs. To cut to the chase, I think that certain shadow people experiences, not all of them, but the core experience, which is the bedroom visitor, which surprises people at night, is a monitoring kind of experience, which is related possibly to ETs. Abducting ETs monitor us by wanting our physical data, our genetic material. Shadow people seem to be very interested in our consciousness. They come to us while we sleep. I think that there is something in our sleeping and dreaming consciousness that enables them to come through. They come through walls like ETs. They don't take us anywhere, but I think they tap into our consciousness, and quite possibly they might even be programming us.
They seem to be very non-threatening, according to most of the people who call Coast to Coast. I mean, they see these entities, and in some cases they think the entities aren't aware of the human being, but they don't seem to be afraid of them. They just seem to be lingering around, maybe being observers. Do you pick that up too?
Well, actually, people are quite terrified of them, and in the hundreds of accounts that I've collected, there are three words that show up over and over again: fear, panic, and terror. There is something that radiates from these entities that absolutely terrifies people. However, I haven't encountered any episode of actual harm being done.
Right. Nobody's been attacked. It's the fact that they see something in their bedroom in the wee hours. I'd be afraid, too, if I saw something on the wall.
Well, they do say that these figures radiate a malevolence or a trickster quality. They think that they're up to no good. And it's...
There are also instances where the shadow entity seems stunningly surprised and shocked that it's being observed.
They tend to disappear. They tend to disappear when they've been surprised. I think when we notice them, they disappear. They vanish into thin air. They go through walls. They run down in hallways and then they vanish. They slide back under the bed. They go into the closet.
So is this not possibly a higher technological observation program, either from the time travel aspect, the future, or another dimension, parallel universes, and all that.
Which is what I believe.
Where you basically have a bunch of grad students, and they're on this thing, and they're looking at us, and they're not supposed to, you know, interact, because that destroys the experiment. They're just supposed to observe.
It could certainly be something like that. I think we are being observed and monitored, and that data is being collected. I do think the possibility exists for some sort of programming, because they're tapping into our dreaming consciousness, our sleeping consciousness, when, you know, we might be more vulnerable to that sort of thing. They have a similarity to Men in Black by their appearance.
They have hats in some cases.
They have hats, dark coats. It's almost always a tall male silhouette. They don't communicate, though, and they don't have facial features. But again, it's a threatening kind of presence where the Men in Black come and threaten people not to tell something. The shadow people have a similar kind of shape, a similar sinister aura about them. And when I began seeing these connections, I went back to my respondents and start asking specific questions about their ET experiences, which is something that I hadn't done in my original questioning. And I'm still getting back data from that, because I've only been doing that about a month now. But a fair number of respondents have had ET experiences that correspond to the times when their shadow people experiences happen. Is that a direct connection? Can we prove a direct connection? It's maybe, maybe not, but it's one of those odd coincidences that we find a lot in the paranormal.
With the collapse of the wall and the Soviet Union and the whole, Cold War, we've now had access to a tremendous amount of Russian research, this torsion physics that I've talked about the last couple of years. Part of that research has to do with bona fide, verifiable time travel, experiments that actually, particularly done by Kozarev, that demonstrated that some information is somehow coming from a future. It doesn't take much to take that paradigm, move it sideways to the area of consciousness, and say that there are whole entities. This is why I'm so apprehensive of your experiment, because we live in a universe, a multiverse.
You're talking to someone who's going to be in there with me.
I know. She's talking about that. Yes.
She agrees.
We've had
with
a discussion.
Yeah. My point is that we're dealing with a multiverse where we have multiple potential consciousness with multiple agendas. And when you open doors and you don't know, you know, you like your surprise doors. If you don't know who's behind door number two, do you want to invite that entity to come to dinner?
You don't automatically have to invite the entity to come to dinner.
Hopefully not.
Yeah, I agree. Let's take some calls with you, Rosemary. Let's pick it up by going east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm coming from Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, go ahead.
And, yes, Rosemary, the shadow people. You have the old hag. You have the dark shadow people, also described as demons and sleep paralysis. What are the chances that these shadow people, it's something more than a case of sleep paralysis?
Sleep paralysis can be an explanation for all kinds of nighttime terrors and projections. I don't think that it could explain every shadow person experience. I have had people volunteer that they think that their emotional turbulence has been a factor in their experiences, that they've somehow projected something that coalesces into a shape. However, this core experience is reported by so many people through such a period of time that I don't think that natural explanation suffice. I think that it is a bona fide paranormal experience. I also think that there are different kinds of shadow people, and some, yes, are related more to the old hag syndrome, the attacks of something that seems demonic and malevolent. There are relationships to thought forms, to vampires. There are haunting presences that we call shadow people, which are dark figures. Richard was just talking a little bit ago about time travel, and it could very well be that these figures are something that do come from another time, another dimension, and maybe they can't fully manifest in our world, and that's why they show up as a dark form. They have the interesting property of obstructing light and objects when people see them, so they seem to have solid, tangible mass, but then when they want to disappear, they don't obey our laws.
Why aren't they harming people, Rosemary?
They might very well be, but in ways that we don't quite understand.
They'd lose their grant.
Good point.
Here again, I think it gets back to this monitoring and programming. Just to throw out an idea, some shadow people were part of an ET monitoring program, for example, they might be doing things to our thoughts, our feelings, our fears, our consciousness, and that might be where some harm comes in. They may also just be simply collecting data on us to understand how human beings think and feel, and that data might be used in some other way.
Let's take a three-way vote. Do you believe, Richard, shadow people are real?
I've seen them.
So I've seen the shadow rodents and Rosemary. Well,
I've seen shadow people.
When I say I've seen them, I'll be working and there'll be some flicker out of the corner of my eye, and it's happened so many times. I talked to Art about it.
That's Robin saying, "Get to bed, Richard. You've been up too late."
And I'll turn around and there's nobody there, but it's like this peripheral, and it almost reminds me of one of those Star Trek episodes where they change the frequency. And they were moving too fast to be seen by the normal. This is why I'm thinking it's a technology. It's some kind of a monitoring program. You know, using our 21st century terrestrial metaphor of grad students is kind of fun. But it has something to do with observing us in our natural state. And their surprise when they're noticed is so human. It is so emotionally based. It makes me think that we're dealing with maybe ourselves at a future time, coming back to observe whatever we're doing right now.
Let's go to a wild card line. You're on with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Hi there. Hello.
My name's Harry. I'm calling from Texas. I saw a shadow person about a year and a half ago, and it really impacted me pretty badly, in fact. I'd like to describe it to you if I could.
Please,
it was
go ahead.
Not a peripheral vision. It was a face-on. I came out of the bedroom, and I have a habit of walking through the house with no lights on. It's middle of the night. And as I came around the corner in the hall, I came upon darker than dark, and that's the only way I can describe it. It was a definite human shape, thin, lanky, had somewhat of a goatee or beard, like a pointed chin, and it had its hand on my son's doorknob going to his bedroom when I came around the corner. It looked at me, and it was so startled, it jumped. Now, my heart just about came out of my chest, and I was facing straight at it. It was a definite figure. It was more scared, it seemed like, of me than I was of it, though. It turned, let go of the handle, turned, and ran down the hallway and disappeared into thin air. And I don't know if that's a typical description of an encounter.
But and I believe this story. I think you're absolutely telling us the truth, which is very important.
I know I saw it.
Yeah. So this is a very common
This is a very common description that I've heard over and over again of the darker than dark figure, the surprise, the disappearance. If they are some sort of monitoring program, because they don't communicate, and
that's not their role.
It's not their role, but they could be some sort of drone or artificial intelligence, or not completely sentient form that comes to monitor us that may be programmed to disappear when it is observed.
Richard,
well, I had years and years ago when I lived in Virginia, I had a friend who had terrible migraines. And it was impossible for her to do anything about them, and she would just go in a room and lie down and wait for days. And the guest room we put her in faced the hallway, which had a wall with a window, and the stairs came up, and you had to make a sharp left into this guest room. She's lying there on the bed. She watched a guy come up the stairs wearing an Aussie hat, not shadow, fully human, and walk right through the wall and disappear. And she was a totally believable person. There's no reason she would have made this up. It was
they're not making these up.
See, all these phenomenologies have to be put into one overall theory, which then has predictions. The prediction that the grad student model says is that these people are not supposed to be noticed. They're really violating something when they are noticed. They're human, so they react emotionally. They're as scared on their side as the folks seeing them on this side. And the black part is interesting because, to me, it says something about the physics of the interaction between dimensions and light.
Amazing. Rosemary, what have you been working on? What's up next for you?
I'm working on a young adult series on the paranormal, which is launching next year. We're covering witches, vampires, ghosts, Bigfoot.
I love it. Coast-to-coast stuff.
All of those good topics. I'm revising my encyclopedia on witches and witchcraft, and the shadow person experience, which started out as an article, is now turning into a book project because it's gotten to be so big and complex.
And, I still get calls from people who want you always to talk about dreams.
Dreams, favorite topic.
When you and I got together when I was doing my local show in St. Louis back in 1997, 10-year anniversary coming up in September, that's what we did. That was the very first show we did, the Encyclopedia of Dreams. And I'm telling you, our phone lines exploded. I had Southwestern Bell call me the next day, our station. They wanted to know what we did that night.
My favorite dream show you did with Rosemary was when you recounted your dream of the disaster in what you thought was L.A., the twisters and
the
all that.
The three twisters.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I remember
you tried
that.
To get on the air.
Yeah. And Tom wouldn't let
you. And Tom wouldn't let you.
Yeah.
That's the perfect role for Tom. You know that? That's his role.
It sure is. Well, we're rapidly out of time. VisionaryLiving.com is Rosemary's website. You can email her, go to it, and let me tell you, I have referred people to you, Rosemary, when they call in with all their different kinds of situations.
And I appreciate that, George, because I like to help people with all kinds of paranormal experiences and especially dreams. So I do get sometimes a little slow answering the email because I travel a lot, but they do get answered.
Okay. Richard, I want to thank you for being on the program with me. I appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, George.
And now let me tell you that there's going to be a little surprise for all of you coming up next hour. So sit back and enjoy this one because it fits right into the genre of the UFOs that we've been talking about all night long as we broadcast live here from Roswell, New Mexico. But this program would not occur, could not happen tonight if we didn't get the help and support from the city of Roswell and all the wonderful people who've been associated with it. So let me give out some congratulatory names here. Rita Nickum, Don Nickum, Gary Babcock, Ted Sandoval, James Johnson there with the Roswell Police Department. Ha! I'll never get a ticket in Roswell again. Zach Montgomery, he is the planning director. And Colt Gibson, our new country western singer, who also owns the limo company. But I was stuck there while he was singing country songs with me all night. And you, Richard C. Hoagland, thank you for a stellar job.
Thank you, George.